Hey, HD 101 fans, I want you to know that we're crowdfunding a brand new, gorgeously printed hardcover book covering 101 weird, obscure, historically important, and just plain cool Japanese video games. It's going to be called Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Japanese Video Game Obscurities, but we can only put it out with your pledge. So check out hardcoregaming101.net. The link should be pretty much close to the top of the page. Japanese Video Game Obscurities. This is, if we get to do this, it's going to be our best looking book yet, and it's one of those books that it'll be about stuff you've probably never heard of. In fact, I can almost guarantee you won't have heard of almost all of it. So give a hoot, fund our book, $15 for the PDF, $20 plus shipping for the hardcover. Do it! Hello and welcome to episode 82 of HardcoreGaming101.net's top 47,858 games of all time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I can't pick that up. My panelists today are...
I'm Bobinator.
I'm Shoku.
I am Satanga.
And on this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two, you can nominate one game at a time via five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Rule number three, you can nominate games that we've already been nominated, but don't nominate games we've already ranked. See for yourself which games have been nominated and which games have been ranked by checking out bit.ly/47kgames. Is that bit.ly/47kgames? Yes, bit.ly/47kgames. All right, so the first game we're talking about for this episode is... a favorite of mine, Sam and Max Hit the Road. It was nominated by Jack Tree in iTunes Norway. And I just got to say, first of all, if you are a listener and you're subscribed via iTunes of your respective country and you're not in North America or not in the United States, actually, it does take us a while to see what you did, that you nominated something, but we will see it usually within 1 month. And we really, really appreciate it. We really do. Please don't feel discouraged that we don't put you on the list right away. It's just beyond our control because we don't have the ability to create iTunes accounts for every conceivable country. But like, I personally, I think I speak for everybody when I say, when I see like a 5-star review from iTunes anywhere but the United States, like it just makes me so happy because I feel like we're reaching the world. We're drawing the world together within our nerdery, our nerdosphere. And that feels really, really good. Okay. This game, Sam and Max, was developed by LucasArts and published by LucasArts for the PC. It was earliest release date in territory is November 1993, which is actually older than I thought it was.
Ahead of its time. I'm not sure if I'm jumping a gun here, but this is the ninth in what I consider the LucasArts Scum Engine anthology.
Yeah, really quick. So if you weren't here for one of our earlier, when we did Maniac Mansion, the great Caitlin Oliver, check that episode out. But we talked about the Scum Engine, which was kind of built off of that experience they had developing that game. Okay, so it's a LucasArts adventure, which makes it automatically worth your time if you like adventure games, point and clicks. What makes it unique is, I think, mostly the artwork. The artist is and writer is Steve Purcell, I think. He was a LucasArts staff artist, I believe, and he did, I'm not sure if it was before this game or after, but he did like comics for like the little LucasArts fan newsletters.
That was beforehand.
I think that's where these characters came from. And Max himself became kind of like a LucasArts icon. And I know that even as the Sam and Max characters, I guess Steve Purcell must have kept the rights to them in some respect because they were able to make new Sam and Max games. Telltale did some that are pretty good. And Max retains his mascot status even at Telltale.
Too bad they're probably not going to make another because they got the engine they cannot use or else their headquarters will explode like speed.
This game is... I always think of it as like the weird kind of like sick evil twin of the Monkey Island games because it's just... It's not as good of a game... because it's an adventure game, right? But it's not really that great of an adventure game, in my opinion. But it's a funnier game.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah, I personally like this one a lot for its charm and design. But it is probably a lot more abstract than Monkey Island can be. Actually, no, wait. I had an easier time playing this than I did Monkey Island 2. That one actually threw me for a loop in a lot of places. So, you know, your experiences differ with all sorts of these games. But I grew up playing this one in Day of the Tentacle a lot. So it's kind of got a little bit of a sentimental nostalgia points.
Well, they're all great. Like, let's not kid ourselves. Like, they're all great. I'm just saying that, like...
Except maybe The Dig, but...
The Dig has its charms, and we'll have to do it pretty soon.
It has its upsides, yeah. It's just kind of a disappointment.
I'm just saying that a lot of these Scum games are really good adventure games, especially at the time, revisiting them. It's not that they're bad at what they do. It's just that you have so many to choose from now because they're all available. So it's like, do you want to play Grim Fandango? True. Or do you want to play Sam and Max Hit the Road? It's like, that's a tough call. You know, Grim Fandango is a much more interesting, artistically pleasant, and important game in a way. But Sam and Max is a gorgeous game.
Absolutely.
Yeah, its art style runs more abstract than even Day of the Tentacle, which is already pretty abstract. And I guess that's because, I forget if the comics came before the game, but, you know, Steve Purcell, pretty artistic guy. He made this one feel a lot cartoonier than all prior games and, like, more exaggerated. Like, I want to say kind of like classic Looney Tunes.
I was about to say the same thing.
I think Tex Avery, for example, is a really good, you know, or the style of, you know, Animaniacs and Freakazoid and this kind of thing. Really, it fits.
Yeah. 90s WB.
Wow, you're a man after my own heart, Shoku. I
feel very strongly about this game, actually, because for me, so I was replaying it this week preparing for the podcast, and I was surprised by how well it holds up, you know, even compare with Day of the Tentacle, Monkey Island, which are games I absolutely worship, but you have to use the nostalgia lens a little bit to appreciate those games nowadays, even in the HD remasters and everything. This one looks like a great modern indie game to me, you know, it looks like a really nice, pretty game, and I also, like, the one thing that surprised me with it was the crazy, wacky, insane Dada sense of humor. You know, the world is completely esoteric and crazy, and that's what really stood out for me in this game.
If you don't mind, like, Shoka, you was this when you first played it, had you lived in the United States?
I had not.
Are you okay with talking about that?
Sure. So one thing that really I found interesting nowadays is, you know, this game has a lot of Americana in there, but I hadn't been to the US when I was a kid and I played this game the first time. So funnily enough, this whole aspect of, you know, the whole map in this game is exploring the US and you go like Louisiana, whatever, and like the East Coast and West Coast, everything. That did not strike me at all. It was for me just another map in an adventure game. I didn't realize any of these aspects really. I thought it was just another wacky world basically.
Yeah, for anyone who hasn't played this, the catch of the game is that you're basically solving a cross-national mystery throughout a highly exaggerated version of the USA where everything takes place at tourist traps, which were especially a huge thing in the 90s. I'm not sure if they are as much nowadays.
Okay, so I've got to translate the humor of this game in two ways, because a large part of our listener base is not in the United States or not in North America at all. And on top of that is younger than me. So it's like two layers of obscurity, right? So the United States is a fairly large country in terms of area, and it always has been, or not always, but for a while now. And so when in the 1950s, when the proper interstate highway system was developed, which is like a systematic kind of top-down central government created roadmap, essentially. It's like, these are going to be the highways, and we're going to make sure that we connect these roads so that you can get all the way across the country on such and such pathways. And once you connect things like that, you allow people to travel across the country relatively easily because they're more or less straight lines. Once they do that, the famous like Route 66, for example, is one of these early highways. It actually predates the Eisenhower interstate system, which is from the 50s. But anyway, like the point is like what people would do is they would buy up land, or they would have land along these highways, and they would suddenly go from being totally worthless to being kind of valuable in a sense. And they would build, you know, like the standard thing you would do is build a gas station or build a diner. But you could also do something to build something to make people stop even when they didn't need to fill up their car or fill up their bellies. And that was to build a tourist trap. And that's where you get stuff like the world's largest ball of twine or the famous like dinosaur statues, like the hollowed out dinosaur statues in PB's Big Adventure.
I want to say the ball of twine was also a reference to a Weird Al song.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you could do anything with. It's like if you can get people who are passing through to be like, I want to stop here. Like, I'll stop here, take a break, and check out this oddity of sorts. And that's this game is kind of a love song to that whole culture that does not exist anymore, really. it's gone. And it was disappearing when I was a kid, so I know that it's gone now. It's not called Stuckies in this game, is it? The real one is Stuckies.
Okay, then this one is Snuckies in that case. And different shopkeepers all share the sprite of Bernard from Day of the Tentacle, but with various combinations of mustache and glasses. So I thought that was a cute touch.
So the Stuckies is like probably the most, that still exists. You drive along any highway in the United States, and it's not something that's like super famous, but in certain parts of the country, you'll find these like convenience stores that are only located along major interstates, and they're all called Stuckies, and there's nothing you can get there that's of any value. Everything there is borderline poisonous, and but they do have places where you can use the facilities, as Sam the dog famously says. And we haven't even explained, this is about a dog and a rabbit-like creature, right? So it's a cartoon dog named Sam and a cartoon rabbit-like creature. I think technically he specifies sometimes that he's a lagomorph. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a proper name.
They are freelance police, which is one of the funniest combinations of words I can imagine.
You know, are they actually just like vigilantes who just like solve crap to get paid?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Every time they introduce themselves, they have some other funny way of saying it. Like, we are freelance police. We specialize in like beating up punks.
Well, I mean, they have an employer, so that has to mean something, right?
Yeah, they get jobs from the actual police. But I like the idea of freelance police, where like technically there's a crime that was committed, but we don't want to handle it. But we do need to say someone's on the case. So let's call this like cartoon dog and cartoon bunny, who are really, really violent.
Yeah, they get assigned the real oddballs. Oh, go ahead, Shoku.
Oh, sorry. So there's the other aspect of them randomly roaming the world, right? Like both in the comics, in the cartoon that was made afterwards, because there's actually a really funny, crazy cartoon, very much in the vein of Animaniacs and Freakazoid, completely insane and very fun. It's got also all these movie references that the game has as well. They basically roam the world, encounter a random villain, and then take care of him, you know? And so it's kind of this like monster of the week kind of setup or something. And so that freelance aspect is them being like, all right, we're just going to enforce police now. This thing.
Yeah, they have like delegated authority that's been delegated to them that just allows them to hurt people.
Can I say one thing real quick? The way you describe that they're really being hurting people and such, that is one kind of flaw I have with this game. It feels kind of one note at times. Like, they see a situation and Sam says something and Max says he's going to commit violence against it, and like 90% of the time that feels like the joke, and it's funny for a bit, but you gotta vary it up eventually.
Okay, so we might as well get to this now. Like, what you gotta understand about this game and a lot of these like early 90s LucasArts adventure games is that this stuff was funny in a large part at the time because it was not, I wouldn't say it was because it was like taboo breaking so much as it was like, it was funny at the time to see cartoon characters saying and doing stuff like this, because that was not normal. Like, people had a lot of affection for the old Warner Brothers cartoons, as Satenga said, which seemed like kind of more violent and madcap and nihilistic than the average cartoon.
How about this comparison? This game is not too far removed from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, except that Eddie Valiant is also a tune.
I mean, I suppose like a lot of Roger Rabbit is like about like repopulating the world with classic cartoon characters. Like, let's have Betty Boop like waiting tables. And I mean, it doesn't have that. It's more like the spirit of the old, like say like the old Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny cartoons before they developed like kind of self-aware personalities. They were just like agents of chaos that did stuff that could break whatever rules you wanted to break. And I think Tex Avery is an excellent comparison point, because the game doesn't quite get that crazy, actually. It actually reins itself in. It doesn't have just like Sam and Max doing like whatever they want. They can't just like inflict maximum chaos and mayhem upon whatever scene they go to. They try to stick to their roles, but you're right. Like, Bob is right. Like, everywhere they go, they enter the scene, they introduce themselves, they say something funny about what they are and what their job is. And whenever you look at an item, it's like, oh, can I get this? Can I do that? Can I try that? They've got like a funny comment, and it's always like the same joke. It is very much a one note thing. And what I was trying to say, it was like at the time that was really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
It was unique. It was new. And when you play it now, it doesn't have that same appeal, because you're looking back at it after like almost two decades or more of irreverent cartoon stuff. You know, this is like post Simpsons for sure.
I mean, so the one note humor, while I do acknowledge it, I that's true, right? the same structure. Everywhere you go, it's the same thing going on. However, I wasn't bothered with that, replaying it recently, in the sense that, the first thing that popped in my mind hearing the OneNote thing was Wile E. Coyote.
Oh, yeah. The OneNoteiest formula you can ever think of that is still amusing, no matter how many times you view it.
Wile E. Coyote cartoon is like 10 minutes. This game is about probably like 3-4 hours, I guess.
But take the cumulative amount of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons there's ever been in existence. And, that might be a little more.
Look, comparing it to 7-minute theatrical cartoons is pointless, because what this game was is like a game that was fully voiced at the time, which is a big deal. And it was very well animated and very stylistically drawn. And you didn't have that same sense of ennui because you were playing it and you would be stumbling through it like any other adventure game. And if you just go watch a YouTube playthrough, yeah, it gets old really fast because the person who's playing it knows exactly what to do. And so it only takes like an hour or so. But if you play it yourself, it is kind of like an unfolding thing where it's like once you solve a puzzle and get to the next area or you go to the next major plot point, then you're rewarded with a funny quip that you're expecting and it's different than the last one. And at the time, that was a big deal.
I think putting into perspective, like the historical perspective, this is a game in 93. This is pre-internet. And when you're solving something, it took you a long time to like get to the next scene, get to the next stage, the next milestone in the game, right? So whenever you have that payoff of all the Simon Maxiness of a scene, it's been a while since you last saw that. It's not like a YouTube long play. No, it's last 4 hours. It's like a 4-month game or something where you figure it out with your friends.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's the same thing as like when we talked about like King's Quest V, for example, or something like that, where when you're playing the game when it first came out, like, yeah, it's a series of really stupid deaths in the Sierra Games case. But that in and of itself had entertainment value that you can't really recreate today because it's not a thrill to see cartoon characters have animated mayhem on your computer screen anymore. It's been done and it can be done so easily. But at the time, somebody had to draw all that stuff. And it really is. And the backgrounds and the environments of this game are really impressive. They're very, very stylish. But I think we can just kind of skip ahead to ranking it because unless people just want to do their favorite jokes or quotes from this game.
Well, I do want to say something about its actual game design is the quality of life improvements that the Scum engine had been consistently making included simplifying the commands because in the first Maniac Mansion, you had like pull, push, turn on, turn off, move this way and that. And like there are like 12 to 14 commands or so. And they like kind of got a bit redundant. And then like the next game, which I guess was Zach McCracken, they like file a few of those down, simplify things.
That is one small complaint about this game. And I not only have been having a complaint about this game so far, but I do like this game and I think it's enjoyable. Don't get me wrong. I don't mind playing it. And I think it looks amazing, but just a small complaint. It always bugs me in LucasArts games when things don't have reactions to them except for what they absolutely must have. And that's something that, like, the one thing Sierra games do better. And that's kind of an issue with this game, too. And it's a small thing, because, you're not going to use every verb and every object, but I appreciate the extra effort, and I kind of miss that.
One thing I do like about this is, like, you have the option of using max as an item, I think, as I recall.
Yeah, that I do like that.
You can, like, because it's always, like, use this on that, but you can always use max on that, and you get something from it. But you're right, Bob, that pretty much after the first, I'd say, third of the game, as I recall, like, it seems to get a lot quieter. Because there's a lot more walking around figuring stuff out and they couldn't possibly come up with dialogue and jokes for everything. And it does, when you play it, you can see like where they're like, look, we got to make this the first third of this game as good as we can or else nobody's going to recommend it to their friends and it's dead. And they put all their resources into making the beginning of the game really, really good, really, really funny and have a lot of stuff going on. And as the game goes on, it has to rely less on its humor and animation and more on its gameplay value, which is not amazing.
Okay. I didn't want to say that. I appreciate how this game had like less commands actually in Day of the Tentacle because it's less cruft to go through. Not even commands. They're like hand objects. Like look is an eyeball. Talk is a mouth. Like use is like one of those squeezy toy things with the bulging eyes. And that's all cute and all. But now I will agree with you that a bit of a millstone. I think the exact palpable moment where the game's where the game becomes notably less vivacious is, if you got up to this part, the infamous gator golf puzzle, where you have to manipulate a bridge of alligators by swinging fish into water to rescue Max, as he was thrown up there by the bad guy's bodyguard, who's a real jerk. And, yeah, there's not really much for humor here. It's just, you just gotta get those gators in line. And then Sam even complains after the fact how much that kind of sucked. So it's like the developers themselves acknowledging that, yeah, you know, we're not always on point.
So I want to expand on what Sotenga was saying earlier, actually, about the UI in this game. So the interface in this game I find very interesting from a historical standpoint. Because if you look at their previous game, they have the Tentacle. This is a game that still has inherited all the interface from Monkey Island, for example, on the earlier games, Maniac Mansion, all that. This is, you know, like the bottom third of the screen is verbs and icons for items and all that. And this game completely removes that and places the items in a little box in the corner in the bottom left. So it's the first game from LucasArts that really frees up the entire screen real estate for you know, these cool backgrounds and all. I thought it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And then a full throttle simplified things even more, as I recall. I definitely agree with that.
So that's one thing. I think it makes the art in this game pop out a little bit more, you know, than the others. It makes the backgrounds, the scenes really beautiful. That's one thing. All right. So I want to talk about the wackiness of the environments, because, you know, the main quest of this game is finding Bigfoot, right? Bruno the Bigfoot cape and all that. And so you end up being... like, what one thing I really appreciate about the environments in this game is, you know, you go in the museum of all the you know, oddities and stuff. So you find encounter the three-legged man and the guy who's got the, what is it, his head looks like a sink or something like that.
Yeah.
So you're going through all these like weird paranormal aspects of the world, and that's something you don't really have in the other LucasArts games. This is completely, you know, out there crazy game, basically, visually.
Yeah, definitely.
You encounter a UFO and everything. It's really cool.
Day of the Tentacle gets pretty weird, to be fair.
Yeah, definitely. They're my two favorites for a reason. That they're, I think, the quirkiest games that LucasArts have ever made by a long mile, and I like quirky. It is a like genuine type of quirky for its time, not like the sort of indie quirky that you get nowadays that sometimes feels a little manufactured, but that's neither here nor there. These games are just really authentically weird in a way I liked. It's the type of stuff I grew up on. So,
you know how, so for me, the standout scene in that game is this other museum, I guess, that takes place in this kind of like Twilight Zone kind of setup.
The Mystery Vortex, yes.
Right, where everything shrinks and moves and floats and you walk on the wall and all that stuff. And I thought that was a really great example of really pushing the engine, the Scum engine, to like completely its limit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the mystery spot is also a point where the dialogue kind of gets a bit quiet, but I agree that visually the crazy sort of things it does. Now, you have to like match all the different colors with each other to make all the doors open. It was a very unique location. I'm not forgetting anytime soon. Also, I find the premise of Conroy Bumpus, the bad guy, pretty hilarious.
Can I say one more thing real quick? If you're a fan of this kind of humor and this kind of thing, you want to see more of it, maybe check out the cartoon, because not many people talk about that.
I should. Yeah, and those, yeah. Yeah, this is all before the Telltale series, which I still haven't gotten around to yet myself. I do know that there was going to be a direct sequel to this game, but that got canned. And then I guess, you know, when Telltale picked it up, that was almost kind of like the logical extension. But we haven't heard anything about Sam and Max since Season 3 of that, so I'm not sure if their time's over or what, but I can at least say that they were a pretty interesting media aspect for a while.
Yeah, so I'm gonna hear Shoku's ranking first, and then you and Bob can go, and then if there needs to be a tiebreaker, I'll do it.
Sure. I would place it right below Maniac Mansion.
I honestly don't like to put like really alike games like just next to each other like that. I was wondering if you could maybe put a few spaces next to that if possible.
Sure.
I mean, let me just check where Maniac Mansion is. Oh yeah, it's pretty big. Oh, like, you know, if I wanted to say something here, I would say, how about between Mega Man 3 and R-Type, maybe? If that's a logical rationale, I don't know. That was just a point that stuck out to me. I mean, I see what you're doing. It's just that if you rank this next to Maniac Mansion, I'm worried all other LucasArts games are going to be placed right next to Maniac Mansion 2.
You're right. And I've just noticed that Ikaruga is rank 88, and there is no way this game is better than Ikaruga.
You are not the only one who's complained about Ikaruga being there. So, we've had, I think, at least two other guests who just really love that game and are disappointed that while it's high, it's not high. But yeah, I don't know. Between Maniac 3 and R-Type, I'm not really sure if that would be the most appropriate rating. I mean, I don't know, Bob.
I think around R-Type is okay.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking I wanted to place an adventure game in between two action games. And as much as I love this game in particular, I'm not really the biggest fan of most adventure games. It is really only LucasArts stuff that I do really like. But, you know, even then, as much as I love this game growing up, I don't think I played it as much as I have Mega Man 3. So that's just kind of why I was thinking with that. So if anyone else has any other thoughts?
Oh, there's a really cool song in the game.
Oh, which one are you talking about?
The country guy.
Oh, yeah, Conroy Bumpus, the British small Elvis. I wish we get to see more of him because I just like the premise of him, but like he doesn't have as much agency of a villain as he could. I just like the fact that you go to like an evil version of the Graceland mansion, and apparently naturalist John Muir factors into it somehow. It is just ridiculous. Yeah, and then he actually sings at some point. Oh yeah, one more thing I want to mention. This game got very legitimately professional voice actors. Most notably, Sam, Bill Farmer, is probably best known as the voice of Goofy nowadays. So, yep, little fun facts. I'm a huge voice actor nerd, so I like to point out the interconnectedness of all those. But, so yeah, I would agree, though, like, placing it below Maniac Mansion on the sort of, this is more of a renovation, not an innovation of what Maniac Mansion said. Fourth, but it is, you know, still pretty close to that ballpark. I would rank most of the LucasArts games more or less around this tier myself. In fact, I have sort of my own ranking of all the LucasArts game adventure games, but that would be going down a really nerdy rabbit hole. So I think I'm just kind of rambling at this point, so if anyone else wants to say anything, please save me.
No, I mean, I don't.
Okay. You agree with placement then, Zerks?
I don't know. Maniac Mansion, that's pretty high up there. I don't know.
Well, hey, if you want to place it lower, I mean, I'll hear you out.
I'm just saying, like, Maniac Mansion is, like, it's such a seminal game. You know what I mean? Like, it really did do stuff that hadn't been done before, whereas what Sam and Max does is just, it's Maniac Mansion, Day of the Tentacle, Monkey Island, stuff like that, but with, like, a different writer and a different artist. You know, it's got a different auteur behind it, but not really an auteur because, of course, other people had to make this game. But you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's just that stuff. But the adventure stuff, the adventure game part of it is not quite as good. And the humor of it, you know, it's subjective. It's like some people were going to really, really love it and some people aren't. And I think the artwork, you have to agree, is really good. The animation is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, where's Maniac Mansion in comparison to Full Throttle? Just curious.
Oh, that's a good question.
101 Full Throttle.
That's a huge spread. I didn't realize that. Maybe we can place this one below Ikaruga if Shoku is... I don't know. It is definitely around this upper mid-tier ballpark, though, for sure.
Look, let's say you've got three scum games to recommend.
I would say this one, Day of the Tentacle, and hot take, Curse of Monkey Island, I think is the best of that series.
I would agree. Yeah, I'd say the same.
Oh, excellent.
What about for historical value?
Oh, if you want to go more historical, I would say Maniac Mansion, The Secret of Monkey Island, and...
Grim Fandango, right?
Actually, yeah, you know what? That's a good idea, because it's one of the only two games in the Grime engine, and the other one was Escape from Monkey Island.
Right, I mean, I don't think Grim Fandango's on the big list yet, but I'm just saying, like, you got to understand, like, Sam & Max Hit the Road is a great LucasArts adventure game. Is it a great adventure game? It's for the people who've played the other great LucasArts adventure games.
I would agree, even though I didn't play most of them before this one. I see where you're coming from.
Full Throttle, I would put above Sam & Max, not because the puzzles are that much better, but it's because I feel like Full Throttle, like, the appeal of Full Throttle doesn't age. It's always there. Like, whereas with Sam & Max, it's like a lot of the humor is going to be inaccessible to people nowadays. Like, it's just not as funny as it used to be. It's funny to me, but I'm the target market demographic age etc. You know, like I'm, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just not, I don't want to just go based on what I think is funny. And that's not what makes a game special, really.
See, I feel like the slapstick and the sort of like great, how gratuitous the humor can be and how wacky it can be is very, like the whole Dada aspect is a very good fit with the kind of like meme humor that you find nowadays.
It would work, but it's just been done at this point. Like, I just feel like the jokes, this is very like mid-90s type of stuff. This is very cutting edge at the time, but now it's just not as clever because it's all referential humor. And it's a lot about like just the funniness of words. It's about a style of humor that appeals to people who are of a certain education level. And that is great for me, but I don't know whether it translates. Yeah, I'm just trying to think about this game in terms of other adventure games, even other scum games, you know, if you want to get really granular. I feel like it has to go below Full Throttle. So can you just find a place that is lower than where you guys had it?
Well, I just want to ask Shoku, do you think it deserves to be below Full Throttle?
I think this game is more interesting than Full Throttle. I'd say they're not that far from each other.
I feel like Full Throttle has a more of a cinematic bent, which I feel is interesting.
Ooh, we're officially deadlocked.
Time to get the coin.
Okay, so if we put it exactly between the two, where would it go?
Oh, wow. This is between 61 and 101, so it'd be 81. So that's Monster World 4. Like, above Blue Stinger.
Uh-oh.
No.
Oh, no. You hit Xerxes' dog's bower button.
So who has a coin? Who has a coin handy? Above or below Blue Stinger, that's going to be the coin.
So heads is above and tails is below.
Yeah, let's go with that.
I'll live with it. Who's going to flip?
Anyone have one?
Like I said, I spent all my money on Pop Rocks and gum, so.
Oh, wait, I have a coin. I'll bank two coins together so you can see this is legit. You hear that?
Okay. Cool. All right. I believe you.
And I'm going to throw the coin on this glass surface. It's heads.
The immutable laws of science have spoken. And where does that go then? Above Blue Stinger.
Which is number 83.
If it makes it feel better, I feel like Sam and Dogs would hang out.
They do. If you added Dogs Bower to this game, it would make it even better. Dogs Bower is like a NPC in this game in a way.
More or less. So would that be below Mappy then?
Below Mappy, above Blue Stinger. Sam and Max hit the road. Check it out.
Don't forget to watch the cartoon.
That too. I gotta do that.
And read the comic book. It's even better.
Our next game is the legendary Super Street Fighter II Turbo. It was published and developed by, of course, Capcom, released in arcades in February 23rd, 1994, worldwide. And this one was nominated to us by Doom Marine. Wow, the actual Doom Marine. Didn't know he was such a fan of fighting games, but I guess we didn't know him that well.
Well, he gets a Berserk pack, and he can probably, like, lay out most of the Street Fighter competitors, so...
Now, there's a guest character we need... Make it happen, Bassetta.
Yeah, you know, guest characters are all the rage in fighting games nowadays. Yeah, I guess you could say, in a way, this game had the very first fighting game guest character ever. But, like, we're getting ahead of ourselves, so...
So, if you haven't heard of Street Fighter 2, hello, welcome to video games, we're glad to have you. And, this is the, I believe Shoko said this is the fifth revision of the Street Fighter 2 series, and,
Yeah, let's count it first, all the versions before. The original Street Fighter 2, then Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition, which made the bosses playable, then Street Fighter 2 Turbo Hyper Fighting, which then made the action faster and gave characters new moves. Then Super Street Fighter 2, which introduced four more characters into the roster, and that brings us now to SSF2T, always a very infamous mouthful, which Capcom would poke fun at themselves for all the subtitle addings on with Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo X, or whatever that was called.
that Dead Rising 3 DLC as well.
Oh, yeah, right. The one that the PC never got. I'm still kind of sad.
So what's crazy about this to me is that the original Street Fighter 2 came out in February 91. And this version of Street Fighter 2, which a lot of people consider the definitive version of Street Fighter 2, at least for quite a while, came out only 3 years afterwards. So there's five versions of Street Fighter 2 in 3 years.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, when it moved up to Super SF2, that was encoded on the Capcom PlayStation 2 board, up from the CPS1 that SF2 debuted on, and that Final Fight debuted on as well. So the technology enhancements it made were nowhere near as impressive as where we would go with Street Fighter Alpha, but nonetheless, everything looked more colorful, everything flowed a bit smoother, and this was, for the longest time, the definitive extension of the original Street Fighter 2, with 16 characters playable, all the special moves that they would have at that time, some even getting a few new ones here, and probably most famously, the concept of super combos was introduced.
I should say this is not the first fighting to have super moves. I'm not entirely sure which one that was. It might have been actually Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters on the Super Nintendo, which is a pretty good fighting game on its own, but...
Oh, what year was that?
1993.
Hmm. The only thing I could think of that would predate that is SNK's Art of Fighting, where the Haoshokoken super fireball that Ryo and Robert could do was, it took, I think, like some special technique to pull off. But I want to say that the first AOF was the genesis of all that. Although if there's something even before that that had super moves in it, write in, because that's as far back as I can go. But nonetheless, it had now come to the most famous fighting game in the world, and the concept was more popularized at this point. Because, unsurprisingly, even 3 years after its initial release, Street Fighter II was still a big public draw, and by this time, it had amassed a sort of underground appreciation that led to actual tournaments being held over who had the most skills with to pay the bills.
I guess. So what I found really interesting is Street Fighter 2, I think at the time, really introduced a lot of people to like playing against each other on an arcade game, right? If you look at games before that, it was always this like maybe a co-op thing if you're playing a shoot 'em up together. And if it was versus, it was I'm playing against your score. You know, you think of Pac-Man, you think of like all these other games. It was really about ranking up on the chart and each person playing their turn. Street Fighter was like, I'm better than you. I'm going to fight you in this game.
Yeah, I couldn't think. I mean, head-to-head games did exist in the 80s, but I can't really think of any immediately off the top of my head. Unless we wanted to talk Street Fighter 1, which is now kind of infamous for how sluggish it seems and just unresponsive.
Street Fighter 2 was the definitive introduction of versus games, I think, at the time. And what's interesting is these later iterations of Street Fighter 2 were really refinements in that, right? The first one had all these bugs that you could exploit. You couldn't be given the same character on the very first version of it, right?
Yeah, humble beginnings. I think there was like a code on like the Super NES port, but no, otherwise, basically Ryu and Ken existed, so somebody could play that archetype one-on-one, but then, you know, all the other characters aren't quite as lucky there. So then I think as early as Champion Edition, or was it Hyper Fighting, they were allowed to pick duplicate mirror matches. I don't quite remember, somewhere around there.
And so there is an interesting backstory to those as well, which is that a lot of pirate versions of Street Fighter 2 came out.
Rainbow Edition, right, where everybody has a Hadouken that they can launch in midair and at different speeds. Fun stuff.
But my point is that Capcom reacted to those, made patch versions more difficult to pirate of Street Fighter 2, and included those refinements in there so that it's like, oh, you can't just throw people when they land and like things like that.
Yeah, sounds about right.
So, real quick, I want to talk about the previous version, why that's important before we go into what they did with this version, that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
So the thing was with the original Super Street Fighter 2 is that the biggest thing it did, it added four new characters, and they're all pretty unique. Most of them went on to be reasonably popular, except maybe one.
No, I'd say one, extremely popular. One, also very popular. Two, much less popular, but I think one is a bit more hated than the other. I mean, we're being specific here.
Who are we talking about here?
Oh, I don't want to steal Bob's thunder, but I could just quickly go into all the characters. Well, of course, you know, in the beginning, there's Ryu, Ken, Chun-Li, Zangief, Guile, Blanca, Dhalsim, and Honda, and then the bosses, which become playable in Champion Edition, Balrog slash Boxer, Vega slash Claw, Sagat, and M. Bison slash Dictator. Of course, those three names are, except for Sagat, changed around in Japan and whatnot, and other localities. And then Super Street Fighter 2 gives us Cammy, the second fighting game lady beneath Chun-Li, so she was incredibly popular. Fei Long, the Bruce Lee clone, who also was considered to be a badass, although notably less popular than Cammy, but still had his fans. And then Thunderhawk, the large Native American who was created as a second grappler alongside Zangief. He wasn't nearly as popular as the first two, but I think Hawk has mildly more approval than DJ, the Jamaican kickboxer who's all about smiling and playing music, and that's pretty much it with him.
Yeah, we could make a whole podcast about him, but maybe we shouldn't.
I will say the best portrayal of DJ was Miguel A. Nunez Jr. in Street Fighter the Movie. DJ actually had some character there, and he was snarky. I honestly prefer that portrayal over his canon version. It's nuts. I'd love to do a podcast about Street Fighter the Movie someday. Maybe a spinoff, but I'll think about that later.
Do you mean the game, or do you mean the game called Street Fighter the Movie, or do you mean the Street Fighter movie?
The movie and then the game based on the movie. Yeah, there are also two versions of that.
I want to drop a hot take real quick, then we'll get back to the main topic at hand. I think Street Fighter the Movie is worth watching. I don't know if I'd say it's good, but it's entertaining. It is a fun movie to watch.
Yeah, it's incredibly stupid and is in no way accurate to how Street Fighter is normally portrayed by Capcom's actual games, but it's one that I've come to appreciate a lot lately, and it's still one of the better video game movies just for its pure hilarious cheese value. It's you might like it if you can set your expectations back. It might be a surprise. So, but yeah, back on this game here.
What this game does, it adds a lot of rebalancing, because apparently the previous version, they didn't spend a whole lot of time balancing it, so some of the new characters were pretty strong, so I've heard.
Yeah.
And biggest thing of all, introduces the series' first character, and probably one of the most popular characters in the series, Akuma, or Goki, if you're Japanese.
Yeah, the 17th, the brother of Ryu and Ken's master, who apparently murdered him, although later games would scale back Akuma's badass factor by having him apparently survive, but wasn't created by at this point. And basically, he was like one of the first super bosses in all fighting games. The only one before this I can think of would be Reptile from Mortal Kombat. Akuma is sort of like Reptile in that he does play somewhat akin to Ryu and Ken, but his moves are a lot more horribly powerful, and you can also teleport and has a very frustrating air fireball to deal with. And of course, his AI was probably through the roof.
Was it already a double air fireball in that game?
I think in the original, yeah, it was double. Before, when he was made playable, it was reduced to a single for fairness reasons, but
you can also play as him, but people really don't like it when you do that.
I think it'd be interesting to talk about also how, like, he's really dramatic introduction in the game.
Yeah, he warps in and just wastes Bison. There's a white screen flash, and then Bison's just on the floor, presumably dead. He doesn't get up. And this would become the, when he was playable made in the Alpha series onward, the Shungoku Satsu, or the Raging Demon. His very trademark super where he just does something really powerful to the opponent that we don't see, and then he stands over them like, shush. And I mean, yeah, Akuma was just like the most frightening thing in fighting games back then, and I think recent years have kind of shaved off his badass points, but back when it came out in 94, for anyone that could reach him, he was just terrifyingly awesome.
Yeah, he feels like the attack in Fist of the North Star, you know, and then all the hits come in, and then and he's just standing there still, and the guy, boom, bursts away.
Yeah, probably held some influence on that. Although, good luck reaching him, because the computer AI in this game is sadistic. as I remember, anyway. I mean, there are, if you play long enough at it, there are certain exploits you can probably get around to, but I think you had to, like, not continue at all throughout the arcade ladder for the first 11 fights, and then when you got to Bison, Akuma would appear. Or was it you couldn't even lose a round?
I think you had to do on one credit, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I believe, like, not lose one round was the condition.
Oh, wait, you couldn't even lose a round, you said?
I believe so. Let me look it up.
Yeah, best we look this up. I'll be honest, though. I feel like most people who are casually familiar with Street Fighter, this isn't going to be the version that they really remember. That's probably going to be Champion Edition or maybe even the original, but you hear less people talking about this one.
Possibly. I mean, I grew up on SF2 Turbo, not Super, on the SNES, Hyper Fighting, the third iteration. And that's the version I'm most familiar with personally.
The original versions just have all so much pop culture osmosis, and you don't really see people. Let me put it like this. Family Guy never brings up Fei Long. Sorry for such a poor comparison, but it was just the first thing that came to mind.
Sadly, I was thinking of that part where Peter just lists off all the original Street Fighter 2 characters back when I had an inkling of appreciation for the show, and those were certainly the halcyon days of long ago that are not the current times now. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, definitely, except for Cammy, I'd say the four new challengers are a tier down of popularity from the original ones, but you know, there were more characters, and that alone was a interesting motivation to play this. And fighting game rosters would balloon up in fairly short order. I mean, you know, 8 back in 1991, that was reasonable.
Same year as the first King of Fighters, right?
Yeah, King of Fighters 94, which would have 8 teams of 3, 24 playable plus the boss, Rugal. And then that series would balloon to have, like, I want to say one game, like 2002 Unlimited Match or whatever, had like 60 characters in it. I'm also a big SNK nerd, but we'll talk to that later if we get to it. But yeah, I guess also I could say that some people thought that Capcom re-releasing this game was kind of ridiculous, and this is the fifth incarnation of it, but fighting games, in a way, you know, they have some errors and exploits in them that are made earlier on, and then they have to release new versions to add stuff and patch stuff, because this was long, long, long before the concept of, like, modern game day patching and DLC was done, which, yeah, some fighting games, most, I think, successfully, Killer Instinct would just, like, make it one and done, but then add more stuff in as time goes on. But they couldn't do that with Fighters back in the day. They had to release essentially a new game to keep up with all the various editions. And that was just how the way it was. Capcom wasn't the only one who did it. They were probably the most famous slash infamous for it. I want to say, though, that the second most game to have lots of revisions released. In fact, I think Guilty Gear X, I think that might have the original Street Fighter beaten. But now I'm not so sure, because there were actually a few more versions of Street Fighter 2 released like a decade after this one.
That is true. Yeah. To me, what's really interesting about this game is it's really the definitive version of Street Fighter 2, at least for a long time, until the PS2, you know, remaster version that came out, and the HD stuff that came out on modern consoles. Like, this is Street Fighter 2 without the game breaking bugs. It's got increased speed, it's got the increased it's got the new characters, it's got the combo meter, as in the super combo meter at the bottom of the screen. It's got the combo count. It rewards players for doing combos, and it's really built around that. It's the first game that enables, you know, proper tournament play, I feel, and basically esports for the fighting games community at the time. And so in that way, it's like the really polished vision of that game that came out in issue 91.
Yeah, I think I said something to the degree of, like, you know, this, like, Street Fighter was getting all sorts of unofficial tournaments when SF2 was big. And then as that built, you know, 3 years later, fighting games are starting to become a bit of a niche, but increasingly popular subculture. And then throughout the 90s, it would snowball into something even larger, what with other fighting games being out around this time, all of SNK's games and, like, you know, Tekken and Soul Calibur and what have you. But by this point, when Marvel vs. Capcom 2 was released around the turn of the millennium, that was, like, the esportsiest game ever for that game's time. Yeah, Super SF2T would be, I think, one of the first notable games where fighting games as a competitive bracket were created. As I recall, it was also the very first game where I saw tier lists being released of all the, you know, what characters go fight well against others, which ones are not as good against others, who's, you know, considered the relatively strongest characters to play as. Although, you know, tiers are only there for suggestion, and they're not supposed to be like a definitive ranking on every character. You know, you play well with whoever you play as, even if, let's see, I can't get a definitive tier ranking, but I guess Zangief is kind of hard to play as. Maybe Fei Long is, and I want to say there was a tier list back in the day where DJ was at the very top, but that seems kind of hard to believe now.
You recall how overpowered Sagat was in that version of the game?
Oh yeah. Actually, specifically, I remember in Super SF2, you like a certain button codes on the character select screen would have you pick like the character's older versions from like the original Street Fighter 2 with all the power balancings that they had, and old Sagat was horribly banned. Remember that.
Even more so than Akuma? That's impressive.
Around or more so, yes, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, the concept of characters being banned for being too overpowered, or OP in modern lingo, that started with this game, so that's something impressive too. But yeah, no, Street Fighter 2, of course, is still the most important fighting game ever, and this version, while maybe not as better remembered as older versions, was sort of around the time when the fighting game community was starting to form. I mean, I have very mixed thoughts on them, but I will concede that what this game did as a stepping stone to get fighting game players recognized was quite impressive. There is also one more first that this game is responsible for, but with the introduction of Akuma, we have the very first fighting game crossover character ever, because in the same year, Capcom would get licensing rights from Marvel to make X-Men Children of the Atom, and then they decided to slip in Akuma into the game, I guess kind of as a gag, thinking that he's the most powerful Street Fighter character ever and that he's strong enough to tangle with mutants. And then, I believe 2 years later, we would have X-Men versus Street Fighter, thus beginning that series. So Marvel Super Heroes would be the year after Children of the Atom, and then would be X-Men versus Street Fighter. So, and history was made.
You actually made me think of, you know, something that's really stand out to me, especially in the arcade version of Super Street Fighter 2 and onward, is the introduction screen, right? The attract mode of the game.
Yes.
With Ryu facing the camera, huge giant sprite, really well animated, and doing a huge Hadouken, which really looks like a Kamehameha.
Yeah. Yep.
And to me, it's really a way of like them anchoring Street Fighter in the collective minds, you know, at the time, of like these big, powerful characters that can do badass fights and this kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that went a long way to show how cool fighting games are compared to the original. This guy punches out this guy, and they're two generic characters in the original Street Fighter 2. I think they later were named Max and Scott, if I'm not mistaken. But
where'd you hear that?
That's like Capcom was published like all these bios for everyone ever in Street Fighter ever, whether or not they're playable, which I think is actually pretty cute. So yeah, Street Fighter 2, definitely a big deal. Still quite a big deal, all things considered. Even though I think at this time that people were maybe getting a little tired of Capcom jockeying the SF2 crown for 3 years. But then Street Fighter Alpha would come out the year after, and then Street Fighter 3 2 years after that. Alpha was very popular for its time. 3 less so, but that it very much grew on people over the years after.
Especially in the fighting game community, right? Because such a technical game compared with the others.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, and not undeservedly so, considered SF3 Third Strike to be the height of the series. And, you know, not undeservingly, that is a rad game.
Speaking of which, I think now's a good time to rank.
I believe so. I think we've given this more than enough coverage. So
here's the tough question we got to answer here. Is this game better than Third Strike?
Are we accounting for historical value?
Yeah, that is the tricky question. I mean, as much as I like Third Strike, as far as actual recognizability and popularity, well, for reference's sake, we have Third Strike down at 114. I wanted to rate it higher, but Xerxes, who behind the scenes isn't here right now, is not a big Capcom fan, so.
Oh yeah, well, that means we can put this wherever you want.
Pretty much, yeah. Also, not too far below that, we actually have Marvel vs. Capcom 2 and Capcom vs. SNK 2, so I would say, though, that any incarnation of Street Fighter 2 would probably be above these simply because they're better known, but I don't know. This is kind of hard to place compared to what else we have right now, so I want to hear what you guys think.
Shoka, what do you think?
So from a historical perspective, I think this game is monumental.
That is true. We can't deny that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really the refinement of fighting games. It's not like, oh, I've got this cool game where you can fight each other. It becomes an institution at that point. It's really fighting games as a genre, and this is the definitive one at the time, and for quite a long time, actually, right? So, and also introduces all of these seminal concepts, like super combos as an important part of play. So for me, it's a very significant game, I feel. Because of that, I feel very few games have that kind of influence. You know, we're talking about games like Mario 64 and Quake and games like that. I feel in terms of gameplay, it is the fifth sequel to Street Fighter, or Street Fighter 2, I should say. So if we're ranking them individually, then, you know, it's not that big, but I do feel like it fits. Like, if I'm looking at the ranking, I do think it's a more significant game than Super Castlevania 4, for example.
I'd agree with that.
As much like SSC4, I'm not going to disagree with that either. And where do we have SSC4?
One thing we should say, we're probably not going to rank another version of Street Fighter 2. There wouldn't be much point. So this should be higher than any hypothetical ranking of other versions of Street Fighter 2.
Whoa, Super Castlevania 4 is really high. We'd be wanting to place it above that, far above all the other Capcom fighters.
I don't really know. Know for sure if, like, on a gameplay standpoint, this would go above Third Strike. We're kind of just going off of his purely historical context, and I'm not quite sure if that's the right thing to do here.
Well, I'm probably going to have to put in a bit of an arbitrary placement here. I'm just going to... Oh, God. I didn't think this far ahead. This is a lot harder than I thought it would be.
I guess we're kind of, in a way, expected to be putting it pretty high, and that's not a bad thought, just... The problem is, I'm kind of torn between ranking it for historical value or between how it is as a game.
If this is to count for all Street Fighters, including the original SF2, then would there be any other fighting game ever that you think would rank above it for purely time-honored reasons?
No, I guess not.
Then I guess we will have to rank this incredibly high, even though that would be rather distant from the other Capcom fighters we have.
Because, I mean, Mortal Kombat's already on the list, and it's like number 200, and there's, I mean...
Well, Mortal Kombat 2 is a lot better, and I think that is on our list somewhere, so... All right, is it better than Galaga? Let's start moving up.
I can tell you, I think it's a better game and more influential than Robotron.
I don't know. Robotron's pretty important. I mean...
Do love Robotron, yes.
We'll be discussing Devil Dagger soon, and that's for our Patreon friends, and that's... I don't think you'd have Devil Dagger without Robotron, so that's a point.
Yeah, that's a fair model of comparison. All right.
I think we can put it above Toe Jam and Earl, because we don't make mistakes, but if we did, we could say we might have put that one a little high.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm willing to put it, like, in the top 10, I think. You know what? Let's go for it. I think it deserves top 10. It's Street Fighter. Everyone loves it.
True.
Maybe just below Pac-Man. What about that? Because if there's, like, one game that people know more than Street Fighter, it's Pac-Man.
You know what? I can't really argue with that. I really want to know what Shoku thinks, though, because he's the one who's given more, I think, historical context. So, you know, in all of GameKind, Street Fighter 2 as a whole, Shoku, where do you think that would be among the really high rankers here?
I'm trying to see. So, I mean, the games above it, Super Mario 64, Mario Bros. 3, Doom, and Pac-Man, like, no question, they've influenced gaming so much. Street Fighter as well. Did it do more than Link to the Past and Metal Gear Solid? Well, Metal Gear Solid brought the whole, like, AAA Hollywoodian kind of thing, and Zelda just made gaming so much more than, like, going screen by screen and doing some action here and there and became, like, a whole story. But I do think, yeah, so if I'm looking at this list, there are no, like, two-player games, so yes, I would put Street Fighter right below Pac-Man, for example.
All right, are we all agreed? Stanga, what do you think?
Oh, man. At number 8, I would agree, although with a bit of an asterisk, or not necessarily saying that this game plays better than Third Strike or Capcom versus SNK2. I mean, those do play more, I think, involved and interestingly than Street Fighter 2. But as an institution, as the flashpoint of making fighting games popular all the way back in 1991, then, yeah, Street Fighter 2 does have to go that high, even if we're ranking its most definitive incarnation and not necessarily the original game. But that's what it's encompassing. So, yeah, you know what? Screw it. Let's go with number 8. And if Xerxes hates it, too bad. We said it, free versus whoever. So, that's how it shall be.
So is written, so is done. Yes, I will.
champion. Every man in this, the heavyweight champion of the world. I'm punching my way on through life. I don't have time to treat you nice. I will be the champion of the world.
Wow. What a stimulating and, dare I say, tantalizing conversation that was about those games. But you know what? We kept going after that. We really did. I'm not joking. We talked about one of my favorite indie games of recent years, which is VVVVVV. I guess you really don't have to stop, do you? And we didn't. We kept the party going talking about VVVVV, a game that is very hard to say, but is a lot of fun to talk about and even more fun to play. And even more fun to listen to. And you would be listening to it right now instead of this crap. If you're a donor, check out patreon.com/HG101. And if you give us $2 or more a month, you get access to that bonus ranking version of the episode, which has no annoying advert speak in any of it, including this part. And you'd also get access to all the previous bonus shows. It's a very great way of giving a little bit back to Hardcore Gaming 101, which is one of the very, very, like, vanishingly few fan sites or the enthusiast press, as it were, that actually pays its writers and pays its podcast hosts and all that. They do that stuff. And Kurt, the owner, does it only with the help of people like you. So patreon.com/HG101, get those bonus rankings and be a pal. That's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to Jack T on iTunes Norway and at Doom Marine and at Steve T-Rex 42 on Twitter for nominating those games. And thanks to those of you we haven't gotten to yet. We are trying desperately to work our way down that list and get to you as fast as we possibly can. And we hope to be getting to you soon. Thanks as well to my lovely co-host and compatriots, and to our editor and booking agent, Jeff Rude, and to our theme song composer, Miteki, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter, Bob Nader, and an extra special super shout-out to listeners like you. That's right. Without your support and feedback, we wouldn't be able to do this. And if you really want to support us, as I said, go to patreon.com/HG101, donate a couple bucks a month. I know I did. And that will make a big difference. You can also help us out by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, which is Bob Nader's bailiwick. And you can help us out by following at GCINX and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us on our Discord channel at bit.ly/HGDiscord. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to this podcast, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or we'll never show you this thing I found where Akuma can totally do a nudality on Blanca. My uncle from Capcom swears it's true. Until next week, keep keeping it real.